This is a London Undone podcast. My name is Catherine Cartwright. These podcasts give you an audible insight into some curious places around London. This series focuses on the historic and at times peculiar City of London churches, their histories, features, associations, and their spiritual lives. We are sitting in a church called St. Mary at Hill. Can you tell us where in the city the church is?
So it is quite close to the river. The hill in question is the hill going down to the Thames from Eastcheap. Yeah. Yes, so we're kind of between the Tower of London and the monument.
To get here, I had to go down a little alleyway, and I sort of got lost. Has it got two entrances? It's hard to find, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. So, in a way, there's a cut-through from the street, which is called St. Mary at Hill,
yeah.
which is also where you have the church has a nice clock. There's quite a big church facade. But the cut-through brings you round the old churchyard and to the side door, whereas the front of the church is on the west side on a street called Lovett Lane.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, it's a bit...
It's sort of in confusing. Between two lanes. It really is tucked away.
And Lovett Lane is one of the most atmospheric little alleyways in the city. It's got a gutter in the middle and it's cobbled and really narrow. You can't really bring vehicles up it nowadays. Yeah. It's pedestrian. So it's a really lovely little sort of approach. It feels quite different to anywhere else.
Yeah, it does. It does. So it's hidden away. And when you walk in, what do you see?
So you walk in through, there's sort of three sets of doors. So there's the main door, which is on the street, and then there's another little door inside, and you have to go sideways through that. And then you're into a foyer sort of vestibule bit,
yeah.
some stairs and bits. And then you walk through the main door into the church, and you walk into this most fabulous space.
Yeah.
It's sort of light and airy.
Does it remind you of any other churches?
It is like St. Stephen Warbrook.
Yeah, and how would you say it's different to that?
It's more intimate. It feels much less formal.
Yeah.
It's less ornate. It has a dome, but it's a much smaller dome. And you can't really see the dome at all from the outside, from the street. So you come in, and the church is... one of its peculiarities is it's not quite square, but it's... If it were square, you can imagine it would be a square space,
yeah.
and within that there's a cross which is kind of delineated by the four columns, and then the space in the middle between those four columns is the little dome which has a tiny little lantern yeah. on the top. So you've got three panels going up and you know smaller ones near the middle of the dome and then bigger ones at the bottom and with emblems on, which I guess is a bit like the Pantheon.
Yeah, in Rome.
But in a very scaled-down version of it.
The thing that strikes me when you walk in is the lack of furniture.
Yes.
So why is there no real furniture in here?
So, yes, and even actually I was thinking about the walls and things, there's far fewer memorials than some other churches as well.
Yeah.
It's because, although it survived the Second World War, relatively kind of unscathed, there was a fire in 1988... which damaged the rear of us and the pews and the pulpit and lots of things. And quite a bit of the dome and the ceiling collapsed. And so the furnishings are still in storage somewhere and may at some point get restored.
Oh.
And they're quite interesting because the pews were box pews still. So in the 1980s, it was one of the few surviving city churches that still had box pews,
wow.
which was really interesting and unusual. The trouble is, from the church's point of view now, they quite like having flexible seating and chairs that they can just move around. They
yeah.
they do rent out the space quite a lot, and that's a valuable source of income. So they're in a bit of a bind. They have, I think, a lunchtime service on at least one day. They have a Sunday morning service, which is a Lutheran service. So this is still a Church of England church, but the Sunday service is Lutheran. They do a lot of concerts.
Yeah.
Because the acoustics are beautiful. And they've got a fantastic organ as well.
Tell me about the organ, because it does look
yeah.
spectacular. Tell me.
So the church is very kind of white in terms mm-hmm. of the walls, but there is this woodwork, which is quite dark brown, and there's a balcony that runs all the way across the west side. And then above that, and kind of into the arch, is, again, this very dark wood organ case with gleaming gold pipes. And it is a William Hill organ, which is not the bookmakers. It's William Hill, the noted organ builder. And this is said to be one of the 10 most important organs in the country. The carving, it's nicely decorated, very much in the style of Grinling Gibbons, but actually they're much later. And it was a carver called Gibbs Rogers. He worked on the Brighton Pavilion for George IV.
Okay.
But he was very influenced by Grinling Gibbons. So they're, you know, it's this interesting, whatever, 200 years apart, maybe not quite as much as that, but similarity of style.
Yeah.
But both kind of excellent of their day. There's four big columns, and the bottom section, they're really rough stone. And presumably it had panelling around it, or you had the box pews up to the height where they become presentable.
Yeah.
So that bit at the bottom didn't have to be nicely finished because it was hidden behind something that was then damaged in the fire. What I also like about it is the windows. They're not huge. So there's two big windows on the south and the north face, and then two smaller windows, and two on the east face as well, either side of the reredos. But the main windows are mostly clear glass, which I'm sure we've talked about red and clear glass things before. These ones are slightly ribbed glass, which apparently he liked because you got the light coming in, but you couldn't see out. You weren't distracted by anything you could see outside. Yeah. But then around them, they've also got these bands that go up the sides and over the top of the arch window, which are really brightly coloured stained glass with lots of sort of heraldic coats of arms and emblems. And so it's a really nice it's a little jolt of colour in this otherwise could be quite austere.
Yes, without that, this is very black and white, the church.
Yeah.
Or grey with all the monuments. And there are monuments on the wall. Are any of them memorialising people of note, do you know?
There's one where the stone is kind of missing, but you can see a bit of the structure of how stones are hung on the wall, which I quite like it.
Now, this church has a connection to Billingsgate. Can you tell me about that?
I think that's why they chose this colour of carpet, and it's grey, bluey shade, a bit like rippling water.
It is, actually. Yeah, it is like the sea.
So it's reminiscent of the sea. And so Billingsgate Fish Market is just down the bottom of the hill, so this is the only church in the ward of Billingsgate, I think. And so they have still a harvest festival, the Harvest of the Sea, every year. And people from Billingsgate come and set up this amazing sort of array of fish.
Yeah.
So my name's Thomas Wicker, and I own a company called Wicker Fish. We're at the Harvest of the Sea Festival. It's a charitable event, so we go around the market, myself and Bill, go around and we ask everybody for donations. And then to celebrate the Harvest Festival, we set a fish display up, and people donate from the congregation. And obviously we give the fish out. Anything that's left goes to the Seamen's Mission in Whitechapel.
Do you know how long this has been going on for?
Bill, do you know how long this has been going on for, this Harvest Festival?
It goes back to the 18-something. It always has been.
What was your name, sorry?
Bill Hallett.
So did you used to work at Billingsgate?
Oh, yes, I worked up here. This road was all live eels, jelly eels and things like that. See that along here, there used to be lobster tanks. I used to work in there. It was the only inland lobster tanks in England. Oh, yeah.
So tell me what it was like to work at the old Billingsgate market.
Beautiful. Beautiful. You knew everyone. I mean, you had to be a relative to work there. It's the only way you'd get in there, because it was a closed shop.
Yeah.
Family only.
So you come from a long line of...
My family were all porters.
And sons, daughters? Well, what have they
No, I'm the last of the line. All of mine, I'm a millionaires now. They all live in Essex.
Dealing with fish at all or not?
No. I'm the last of them. I mean, all my family worked in it. And as I say, in them days, when I was a kid at 15, I came here straight out of school, you can imagine, January, snow on the ground.
Oliver Twist.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, just out of school, what did you know? I had to handle fish, freezing cold in with ice. But you stuck it, because you loved it.
See further the blessing of the fish. Blessed be the Lord God, creator of the wide immeasurable sea, and living things numberless, both great and small. Bless these your creatures, whose life has been given for our nourishment.
Are there any other associations with anything nearby?
In around about late 18, early 1900s, the vicar was a man called Wilson Carlyle, who founded a thing called the Church Army, and it seems to be a sort of a bit like the Salvation Army. He was busy trying to reach people who didn't come into normal churches, and he played the trombone. So before services, he would walk around the streets, and they'd sort of get this together, this parade, and they would have a service of an evening. So they would kind of walk past all the local pubs playing his trombone and trying to entice people out of the pubs and then draw them into the church. And they used to have the most like jam-packed services with lots of music and things. It was really, really big in the early 1900s.
And actually, that the picture you just pointed out of him holding his trombone from the pulpit gives us an idea of the decoration in the church as well. And you can see that pulpit's probably against this pillar even.
Absolutely. And the amazing thing about the pillar, if you look up, you can see how big the pulpit will be, because there's some bits of kind of metal sticking out where that, so that this right at the top would be the big sounding board.
And the church that we're standing in, when was the church, this church, built?
Well, after the Great Fire.
So this is a Christopher Wren church.
It is Wren. There's quite a lot of suggestions that Robert Hooke either maybe was quite involved or did drawings. Sometimes when you look at the drawings, they're clearly in Robert Hooke's hand, but it doesn't necessarily mean that he designed it, or maybe he did the drawings or whatever. So it's, again, right, it's a bit vague. But there's a definite Hooke connection as well.
Okay.
But yes, Wren.
But it's a Wren church, and there was a church that stood here before that.
Yes.
So where we are, so we've come in through the main door, the little front porch, and we've just turned left. There are some stairs going up to the organ, and then against the north wall there is a carved panel which is quite striking.
It's a resurrection panel, so it's a scene showing the resurrection. Got a feeling of the sort of Last Judgment as well, because you've got lots of bodies and lots of limbs and buildings collapsing.
It's a muddle of limbs, I know what you mean.
So this is the bottom. It looked like a building falling apart, but actually it's coffins. It's the dead climbing out of their coffins. So you've got lots of coffin lids and lots of naked bodies.
And they're climbing out to be judged. And was this from this church, do we know?
It was. It was brought inside to protect it, because it was obviously getting a bit weathered. So in the 1670s, when the church was really being rebuilt, it seems like that's the era that it's from.
So we've come out now into the churchyard. We had to come a convoluted route for reasons that you explained earlier. The entrance to the churchyard is on St Mariot Hill rather than Lovett Lane. And you mentioned that the churchyard is a bit odd. Tell me why.
So there's a sort of path around the side, two sides of a rectangle, which is street level, more or less.
Yeah.
And then there's a wall, and then the churchyard itself is paved, and there's a couple of trees, and one of them actually is the most magnificent magnolia. And in the spring, it is like for about 6 weeks, it's coming, and then there's 1 week, it's just like, oh, the magnolia blossom.
Oh, how lovely.
And then it's gone.
And that's this one straight in front of us.
Yes.
With the most ginormous leaves that are still just about clinging on.
Yes, and lots of Christmas lights wrapped around it as well. But the paving of the bit inside the wall is about sort of mid-thigh height, if you're standing on the path. And it's probably because it was used as a plague pit. So those 70 people from the parish who died, some places they didn't dig the graves deep enough, and then they piled up
the bodies
and built walls outside.
And the plague being the plague just before the fire, the 1665
I think
plague.
So
and actually from here you can see quite clearly the tower, which isn't like other Christopher Wren towers in as much as there's no top.
Steeple.
Yeah, it's just a straightforward tower with crenellations at the top.
Yeah.
Which is in brick.
And I wonder whether, because St Clement's also doesn't have a steeple, and with St Clement's it's because I think they never had the money to build it. You know, so quite a lot of them, they built the tower as soon as they could, or with the church, and start using it. And then they came back later and added a steeple on top when they had more money. So maybe the same applies.
You get a West Country lemon salt. Oh, boy. You're celebrating what there is. God's earth, that's what you're celebrating, what's in the ocean.